Hello everyone. Today I'm having a Zoom conversation with Erdem Taşdelen. Erdem is a Turkish Canadian artist who currently lives and works in Toronto. His practice is rooted in conceptualism and involves a range of media, including installation, video, sculpture, sound, and artist books. His diverse projects bring structures of power into question within the context of culturally learned behaviors, where he often draws from unique historical narratives to address the complexities of current sociopolitical issues. I met Erdem during a research for our traveling library exhibition, House of Wisdom. We exhibited his artist book Convictions and how beautifully Erdem describes as this artist book comprises 47 concise anecdotes written throughout a number of years leading up to its publication. Each of these anecdotes describes a situation where I become aware of my queerness as a result of an interaction I have with another person. Viewed together, the collection provides an intimate look into how I position myself as a queer individual and it serves to remind that one is only queer in relation to others. His memories and words traveled with us for years, and since then I'm following his work persistently. During the last month's conversations we had with our friends who are also working in arts on exhibition experience and how pandemic changed our understanding of curating and exhibition making, Erdem's last solo exhibition, A Minaret for the General's Wife, and its video walkthrough was cited repeatedly. So the last time we met with Erdem, right before I moved to London, he was visiting Istanbul and we met in a local wine bar in Taksim and had such a laugh over many memories and we thought we were going to meet in London. He was invited to a residency at Delfina Foundation, but then many things changed. Today, this is the first time we had a chat after a year and we talk about how this last year affected our practices, also about his recent exhibition, his ongoing works and many other things. And I hope you enjoy and please check out the episode description for the links we'll mention during our conversation.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hello.
Nice to see you again.
Exactly. So lovely to see your face again.
Likewise.
I know it's a bit weird to speak in English with each other, but...
But I'm sure in another context, we would have probably come together and spoken in English anyway at some point. It's so interesting also to hear about Convictions. I haven't thought about that work in years and years.
Such an incredible memory for us as well. And that work specifically was just very, very important. Each time I just read another anecdote from it and it was either an installation or a book, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you for that. That was, yeah, that's it's one of those things that comes back every now and then.
Yeah,
I'm so happy to have done it. It's not the sort of work that I would necessarily make today, but I'm just so happy that I made it at some point.
Yeah. And it's like, I think writing is like one of your core practices and I wanted to just ask you about that. But first, maybe can you tell us like, where are you at the moment and how... A weird year for you and how it affected your practice maybe in general, if it's possible to even explain.
I'll try to summarize in a few sentences. I am in Toronto right now, which is where I have been living for the last 5 years. Before that, I was in Vancouver for a long time, but now I kind of think of myself as a Toronto person in some ways. And I'm very much here in the sense that I haven't traveled at all for a year. I'm just in the same neighborhood all the time. And it's been kind of a really interesting time because like I had a lot of things, plans lined up, obviously, when this whole thing began. I had just come back from traveling as well in early March. So everything just happened so quickly, as was the case with all of us, I suppose. But plans got deferred, some plans got canceled. Like travel plans were pushed away into the future, obviously. So this current solo exhibition that I have at Mercer Union, which actually is not open yet, it was installed, but it's still waiting for lockdown orders to end. So that was supposed to open in June last year.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, it's kind of incredible. In some ways, I think I said this to you earlier, that it was a bit of a blessing in disguise as well, because it gave me an opportunity to work on the project a little bit more too. So I was preoccupied with that for most of this time. And now, like, the second wave in winter, of course, is a bit of a different story. A lot more time spent at home. But I'm in my studio at the moment, and I really like this space. I moved into a new place in September. So that novelty has been really helpful as well.
Yeah, I can imagine. I'm happy to hear that there is also like a positive side of it with the these exhibition making. Of course, I really want to experience that exhibition. Looks and sounds incredibly interesting, but the video walkthrough that you made, it's such a good format. And I wanted to ask you, like, how did you come up with that idea? And especially for this exhibition, it's very important. Even if you just like maybe visited physically, that you wouldn't just grasp all these elements, but
for sure,
very short format, you just like articulate everything perfectly well.
So that came about in a very interesting way and was completely driven by COVID as well. It wouldn't have happened otherwise. First of all, we wouldn't have filmed such a thing to begin with. So basically, I mean, I'll tell you about logistically how that happened and maybe say a few things about how it came to be in that format specifically. When we were installing the exhibition, we knew that we would probably have to shut down for a while. We didn't know when that might happen, but that possibility was always looming. And so there's there kind of an association / foundation, something resembling like Saha in Istanbul. They're called the Toronto Friends of the Visual Arts. They actually approached Mercer Union and said, we are, as a result of COVID, we're opening up this new like limited funding program for public engagement online. So we would encourage you to like apply for funding so that you can create new content for exhibitions to be engaged with on the internet, which is fantastic. So they went ahead with that and they got some money. And that's why we were able to hire a professional cinematographer. In that sense, it wasn't like a very DIY kind of thing. It was actually a very much produced video, which is also why it's like so highly stylized and like, I don't know. I really like that it's like produced with such, you know, high quality, because things are so haphazardly done.
Yeah.
Because obviously like it takes money to do these things, right? So then once I knew that that was going to be done, we settled on something like 4 to 5 minutes, because we know that, you know, like that's about the extent of what people will probably watch on YouTube. So I didn't want to do sort of like a long artist talking about all the details. So I actually wrote a script. So that entire thing, and I practiced it for days, so that whatever I'm saying in that video is actually from a script. I'm an actor in that video, which is, I mean, it kind of felt like making a work in some ways. So that's actually why you might think that it's so concise in that format, because I wasn't like rambling. I was, I wasn't like extemporaneously done. It wasn't script. So I basically came up with a few items to say, okay, I have to talk about this, this, and this, and this. Wrote it out and made sure that it was like 4.5 minutes. And we filmed it over like one afternoon, observing all, you know, like COVID protocol, other than me having to take off my mask when I was in front of the camera.
It's a great like example of a format that I never seen it throughout the year, because I think we were just like really going through all other possibilities, you know, like, okay, the exhibitions are not closed, but we were really missing that experience. But how it's just going to evolve or maybe change during like the pandemic, because I think it shouldn't be just like either an online exhibition or a physical exhibition.
Totally.
But it's just like within the story, maybe we can also talk about its story, like the exhibition story as well, because it's also very interesting. But I think within that story, this format worked really well, because you also have to read a lot, I think, when it comes to your exhibition. It's just like there's like this element that you can be just with yourself, with the text, with the sound, and then you can still experience things. You don't have to be in front of that object, which I really like.
It was actually really helpful for me as an exercise too, because I never like prepared something that's this short format to talk about an exhibition or a work, right? So then I actually started thinking, oh, maybe I should do this for like all of my project, not necessarily to film a video, because like I might not have the means to be able to do that. What is like the essence, the core of this project that I need to tell people about? That's actually a very important exercise for an artist to do, I think.
Definitely. And I think during that walkthrough video, you mentioned that how pandemic pushed you to think about how the works will be engaged with the exhibition space. Can you mention that, like how it just changed for you to curate the show as well? Like how the...
For sure. So one of the major considerations was So in the exhibition, there's a booklet of texts, 12 texts that I've written. And it's, you know, like it's a substantial amount of text. Like it's a booklet, right? It takes a while to read. But over the many months that I worked with the two curators of the exhibition, Julia Paoli and Tulin Took, we actually worked really closely together. Like it was really developed with their involvement. So part of the discussion was, okay, there's all this textual material, but what is this material? How is this given to the audience? Like, is it going to be, because initially I was thinking I'll produce like a very like high production value copies of this thing for people to read in the exhibition space, because it was important for me to, for people to have seen all the things in the exhibition while being able to read the texts. Like I didn't want the book to have a life outside of the exhibition by itself. But of course, there's a very practical consideration of how do you have the, you know, people coming into the gallery handle the same thing. Of course, this is also when we thought that COVID was transmitted primarily through touch, which turns out not to be. It turned out that we actually had to give each person their own booklet. So then once we decided that, it was sort of like, well, why can't they just take it outside and take it home and home, right? It makes no sense. So that's like one very, you know, specific practical consideration. But at the same time, the way that the whole exhibition is set up, sort of in a way that looks like the space is suspended while it's in use, like all of these objects lying around where, you know, they normally you wouldn't see in an exhibition space. So it kind of looks as though there were people there right before you doing something, like maybe workshopping a story, or, you know, drinking bottles of wine or whatever. So then that took on a whole new meaning in terms of how the public engages with the exhibition when they come in to the gallery, because, I mean, this hasn't really been the case yet because it hasn't really been able to open to the public. But the way that visitors will be able to see it will be that it'll be by appointment only. And each person making an appointment will have an exclusive 1 hour slot for them. So it's not a collective experience. Seeing the exhibition is not, it's a very solitary experience. I mean, you can bring someone with you, but they have to be from the same household or something. So it's a very intimate kind of experience where there aren't people around. And I think that that whole thing made me develop the exhibition in this way too, knowing that it would be like a solitary experience. I started thinking about how do I make this exhibition look as though like you're surrounded by people in their absence? How do I create a sense of like togetherness when we can't see each other, when we can't be in close spaces together, right? When I first installed it, I actually cried in the space. I was thinking, my God, like I can't be in this space with people. I think to me, there's something very touching about like implying bodies in that space when they can't actually be there. I mean, this is turning into a very dramatic.
But I mean, that's the whole point, I think, to learn what's behind those stories. And I think that's just very beautiful to know that. For example, I didn't even think about that. You can't just, that's going to be a very like individual kind of an experience. Here, it was kind of like a different experience. Like you would go to exhibitions, you would still like book an appointment, but then when you go to the exhibition space, you would see other people around you. Yeah. So that's just kind of like, you know, you always assume what you're like surrounded by, but I think we all lived in different realities throughout.
And also, I mean, I actually went to the previous exhibition at Mercer Union in exactly this format. So I had myself in that space. So I do have that experience. And it was just a really interesting way to experience an exhibition, knowing that nobody is going to come in. You are there by yourself. Sometimes you go to galleries and you're by yourself, like an unusual thing, but knowing that nobody could possibly come in, thing, right? Yeah. So then it's how do you engage with work then? Because I think, for example, if I were given a booklet to read, I think I would be more inclined to stay in that space and read it in that space, knowing that like there won't be people coming in, like I won't be interrupted. Or like watching a video, like same thing,
Exactly. I was going to say that because I think that's the only experience I had with the situation where there was like a video room. I think they were like with surrounding sound system, so they had to just like lock you into the room, and you know that in the room you're alone, but that's just like completely different. And I was always imagining like, okay, so if they know that they're alone in this room, probably they're not just like standing still where you see like lying down and maybe just checking their phones, and then they just like feel more comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I was just also going to refer that the stories you wrote and then how the book is actually like one of the main aspects of the exhibition, and maybe we talk about the stories, but and do you want to just like shortly mention what the exhibition is about?
So a few years ago, I came across an image of something, a very weird structure on the internet, which is a minaret without a mosque, so a freestanding minaret in the middle of nowhere in Lithuania. So then I eventually applied to do a residency in Lithuania, went at Rupert, an artist in residence program. So I was able to spend some time researching the history of this thing. There is, I mean, there's kind of like a long story of how this thing was built, which maybe I won't get into now. But what was interesting to me was this myth about its origins, which was that it was built by a Russian general for his Turkish wife in the year 1880. And this Turkish wife didn't actually exist, but I was kind of interested in how these structures in the public realm are given meaning in different ways by different people, how they find their meanings collectively. So I started writing about the minaret from different perspectives about this minaret. So some of those perspectives are actually real historical figures. Of course, the narratives are made up by me, and some of them are completely made up by me. They're not people that have existed. And I was given, fortunately, a lot of archival images to use in the exhibition as well by the director of the regional museum in this place called Kėdainiai in Lithuania. So all of these things they came together in the exhibition so that it looks as though there's a lot of objects and photographs and things that look like they're like theatrical props to be picked up and used while you're creating a story. So I've had an interest in like ideas of performance for a number of years, and they've manifested differently in different works. But this is, I guess, how all of these things came together in the end in one exhibition where I'm not putting on any real performance works. But I'm giving people the tools with which to imagine performances. So those stories in the booklet that I wrote, I wouldn't necessarily call all of them stories. They're all very differently formatted. Like one is a poem, for example. One's first person perspective on the minaret. One is like a person coming into the exhibition, actually looking at the exhibition itself. So all of these things that tangentially relate to the minaret in some way in their narrative. But the idea is that all of the objects in the space are things lying around, and the booklet is almost like a key with which to unlock all of those things, relate to each other in subtle ways that you might not immediately be able to see. I mean, that's a very roundabout way of describing something if you haven't actually seen what it looks like. But I think what I'm saying will probably make much more sense.
And we will share everything in the in the description where the images as well. That was just like very interesting for me to just like read the story and then to realize that you actually created characters as well. And they're just like, we don't know who they are. And then you do it sometimes with your practice, which is really incredible. And then through their eyes, like, what do they think about this topic? And it creates such as like a collective by itself that, again, like, okay, maybe you're alone there and this is like a one person research project, but either you're more interested with the masses rather than...
Yeah. I mean, that's also partly why in the end I wanted to include one text. That was the final text that I wrote, actually. That is a visitor to the exhibition, like stumbling upon the exhibition by accident because they intend to see they know anything about it. So, because I wanted to kind of imply to the audience, okay, like this is actually something that you're also implicated in.
By the way, also reminded me of your ongoing work, Characters, when you just mentioned like these different voices. And I just when I go through your website, I just realized that you have an upcoming exhibition. Mm-hmm. So should we just like maybe talk about it as well? It's also very,
sure,
very
of course.
Interesting. I mean, talk about it for 5 hours, but I have my personal favorite characters.
So maybe I'll just quickly say how that came to be. Mm-hmm. I did a number of years ago, I made a work titled Wild Child, a video mm-hmm. work, where I had actors acting as though they were auditioning to be in a film. Mm-hmm. What I was really interested in through that process in the end was, with the limited amount of information these actors are given from a script, how do they immediately interpret a character and turn it into a type of person form in front of you, right? They're not given like a lot of information, so they have to like make a lot of inferences. Mm-hmm. So that led me to research the notion of stock characters in film and theater. And apparently the first set of stock characters, ostensibly, is a series of texts called The Characters, written by a man named Theophrastus in ancient Greece. And what this work is a collection of 30 character sketches, textual character sketches that describe 30 different types of people. But interestingly, all of these types are negative types of people. So mm-hmm. historians don't know whether he wrote positive ones too, and they just never made it to us, or he planned to write them and never got around to it. But I thought it was really interesting to read this text where you essentially think of humanity as being made up of like 30 types of awful characters. You know, in a lot of ways, I think, given you know how our world is evolving at the moment, that kind
maybe of an accurate kind of an observation.
Yeah. So then I started to think about, okay, like how do I actually take up these characters and create mm-hmm. something with them where I'm imagining them existing in the same space in some way. So I started imagining a near future society. We don't know where in the world, but all that we're able to glean is that a series of like awful political events have happened wherever they are, and they're negative characteristics are highlighted because of these events. And so I wrote a monologue for each of these character types. Each of the monologues is about 5 to 6 minutes long. And I worked with voice actors to actually record all of these performances. The work in the end is a series of 3 sound installations, act 1, act 2, act 3. The reason that it happened that way was because it just wasn't logistically possible to put 30 of the characters in the same exhibition, because that you would need like 3 hours to view the work. But also in each of the exhibitions, each character is represented by an image that is accompanied by a speaker. So it actually requires a lot of space as well. So the first act of The Characters was shown in the city of Calgary in Canada in late 2019. The second one was shown in Saskatoon, February, March last year. It actually closed a little bit early due to COVID as well. The third act is finally going to be shown this year at the Art Gallery of Burlington, which is a city in Ontario about an hour's drive from Toronto. So each setup is a little bit different based on the needs of the space and, you know, the materials that I have access to, I guess. Mm-hmm. But the core is the same, where each act is about an hour long and is made up of 10 monologues of 10 characters.
And now for the next couple of minutes, we will listen to the voice of the suspicious one as part of the act 3 from the forthcoming The Characters.
I was a tourist in a city I've never been to, and I can't really say where in the world it was. I was walking around, taking in the sights of the exquisite architecture, when I came across a very large museum. The entrance to this museum was in this majestic square where there were a number of sinister-looking statues. Historical figures, the types you might see in a public square of that kind. Bronze, domineering, masculine. They seemed like they might come alive at any moment and start attacking me. There were also large, colorful banners on poles advertising the museum. I had some time to kill, so I thought I might as well see what they're showing. When I entered through the gates, I found myself in a large hall that looked and felt like a train station. I joined a long queue, which I thought led to the admissions desk, but then it somehow dawned on me that this was actually a passport control line. I looked around and saw a well-dressed, handsome security guard nearby and asked him if I needed a passport to enter the museum. He said, "Yes, naturally. The museum is a country itself." For a second, I thought he was pulling my leg. But seeing that the other people in line were holding their passports in their hands made what he said seem plausible. I realized that, in fact, I had my passport on me, in the way that things magically appear as soon as they become part of the plot in a dream. After waiting in line for a while, I finally got my passport stamped and entered the exhibit. It was a vast space that seemed limitless, and I realized that I had found myself inside a replica of a small city. I started walking around, meandering from street to street. I saw stray dogs and children playing. They all seemed joyful and carefree. I entered clothing stores and looked at clothes with vibrant colors and marvelous patterns. I remember the feeling of the soft fabric in my hands vividly. I saw wooden houses that regular people seemed to be living in. Some of the interiors were visible from the windows, and they had such wonderful lighting and hundreds of books arranged on beautiful shelves on their walls. The whole place was characterized by a general sense of safety that I haven't felt in real life since, well, since I was a child, really. It was all just idyllic, I guess that's the word I would use. But I soon began to feel that something was amiss, wondering whether what I was seeing in this huge exhibition was actually art or just life itself in this town, or country, rather. What kind of a budget did the museum have to be able to install an exhibition like this? To have built these lovely houses, to have figured out every little detail down to the patterns of the dresses in the stores, to have brought all these actors and animals here? And did they all leave this country and go home once the museum closed in the evening? Were any of them citizens in this museum country? Did they have passports issued by the institution? Or had the museum just built walls around an already existing town and simply started presenting it as art? I thought to myself, if this is art, this is hands down the best exhibition I have ever seen. But if it isn't art, then I'm just walking around a quaint little town and it's not really all that interesting. The idea that the life I saw around me could be art, with all its actors and activities, was exhilarating. But on the other hand, the possibility that it wasn't art made it all seem so incredibly mundane and pedestrian, not to mention awfully voyeuristic, considering that, as museum-goers, we were prying into these people's daily lives. These thoughts now cast a shadow over all the positive feelings I had earlier in the dream. I no longer felt safe in this environment where I couldn't distinguish between life as art and art as life.
And are you going to choose, like, which characters is going to be in which position this year regarding, I don't know, what we're going through, or they're just like completely...
No, they were already predetermined. I split them up after writing all of the... But the way that I split them up was not because these characters necessarily belong together in these individual groups, but it's just to have, you know, a balanced representation of gender, let's say, in each one, or like different formats of, because, okay, so one thing I should mention is that if you're writing 30 monologues, you soon start to realize how difficult of an exercise this is. What is a monologue? It's somebody speaking by themselves with no, like, input from the outside. So how do you come up with 30 different scenarios where you write this? So there's a, you know, I over time, it took me like over a year to write these things, but so I, when I was splitting them up, I was also thinking about like the different types of writing and performances, not lumping them all together in that way and like scattering them through the three. So ultimately, you know, I would hope that one day I'll be able to show this all together, but a massive exhibition.
Why not? I mean, do you visualize them as well? Is there like a kind of a visual representation for each of them?
So there are, I've designed these like somewhat abstract visual representations for them. And it's very arbitrarily done. Imagination of what this character might look like visually, or like what sense of a personality could be communicated through visuals accompanying sound. And those visuals take different forms in each exhibition as well. So in the first one, it was a series of postcards that people could take away from the exhibition and actually use. Like the back of them was actually designed as a postcard. So I also kind of like this idea of these characters kind of like going out into the world and being sent to different places. In the second one, they were these like circular, let's say, almost like platforms underneath the speakers, like adhesive vinyl on the floor. And in the third one, I'm imagining that they'll probably be, and this is kind of still in the works, but I'm envisioning them to be something like theatrical backdrop. Or like photo studio backdrops where you might actually be able to, you know, pose in front of them. So like a selfie opportunity at the museum.
All thought provided by the visitors. Exactly. I love the third act team though. They have like incredible characters. My favorites all just like in the act three. So I'm like very curious.
Do you want to mention some of their names?
Oh, definitely. So I'm very curious about how the reckless one, repulsive one, and the one with bad taste is gonna talk with each other. But the arrogant one as well. Like arrogant one, I think it's just like a very familiar character. So that
well, I can tell you what the arrogant one is doing. The arrogant one is on a date with someone they just met off of Tinder, and it's their inner interior monologue. They're with themselves. They're like looking at the other person and constantly finding faults with them, thinking about why they wouldn't date that person.
Okay, so it's like basically a million people we know. Hopefully people can actually visit the show. I mean, that's what I hope, that we can soon physically visit exhibitions. But is there going to be a documentation of this act as well?
It's too early to say, I think, because the unfortunate reality is that this was supposed to open in May, but I don't think we're going to be able to keep that timeline. So it might be pushed into the fall. I'm not sure. So like, depending on how things go, like also vaccinations, you know, but the other thing is that it's actually, it's in a smaller city. So their restrictions will probably be different from ours in Toronto. So they actually closed down a lot later than us too. And it's a massive space. It's actually a museum. So it'll be a very different kind of experience. But I think, you know, this is probably something, I mean, I'm sure you've been thinking about this a lot as well, but I think all of this like accompanying materials for people to engage with work on the internet, this is probably like here to stay, right?
Yeah.
Something that people think about in the future,
I think. Yeah. So, I think our exhibition experiences is not going to be the same, to be honest. That's what I feel now. Maybe that's just like too emotional side of me talking now, but I just feel like this is just cannot be erased, that I'm also kind of very interested with seeing the other formats that we're going to come up with, because I think it's just going to be very exciting to see what will be after this. So like during the pandemic, I think there were like restrictions and lockdowns, and also like mentally it was very challenging, but if we just come up with another, like open up our fields, then we will just maybe create other possibilities to engage with art as well, which is,
I think that, I mean, that has so much to do with like the infrastructure of like different countries and how art gets made, right? Like arts councils, I feel like, for example, where you are and where I am in the UK and Canada, might push things in that direction a little bit more, providing more funding for like digitally engageable, which is already happening in Canada, which is why I'm saying this.
Of course.
Yeah. But also institutions.
Like besides the institutions, I think we're just very much focused on what we were doing before the contemporary art movements. I think this is also I'm also expecting a more like happenings and rather. You know, just like on in the moment without documentation, just being like experiencing more in your city, in your neighborhood. And that's what I think we were just talking about earlier, but that's what I was a bit surprised that no one actually used the city as a space during the pandemic. But I also understand that this is just kind of like a very depressing period for everyone. And it's not really motivational, but I like remember the times that when I was, for example, living in Bologna in Italy, that people would just like create things for their street. So it's like a kind of like a performance from their windows, and then they would open the windows and then suddenly start a performance. Whoever is passing by the street would experience that, and that's it. And then they will close the windows and it's just gone. You cannot even take a photo. It's like so suddenly there. And I was just saying that okay, this will happen now, so now we're all stuck, and this will just like, you know, I was so excited about, but then that's a different than being locked down in a house than creating something for your street in a regular day. Maybe
it's I just also had a thought while you were saying all of this that like, for example, for me it was a really interesting thing to think about making an exhibition knowing that no one from outside of Toronto is going to be able to see it, because usually, you know, there's, if you make an exhibition in a big city, there is the expectation that international travelers will see it. So I wonder, like, if in London, for example, if people were thinking everything's so internationally contextualized in London that maybe if people thought, okay, like if this is going to stay local, then, you know, like we have to grapple with that.
It's like all these like different dynamics that we never thought about. We'll just like challenge the art engagement. Okay, I have like other questions, but we're just curious, what have you been reading throughout the pandemic?
I've been reading a lot more than I imagined I would, actually. So I keep kind of falling into like dystopia. I just finished reading Station 11. That's why I'm saying this. So I resisted reading that for like months and months. And then finally I was just sort of like, okay, maybe I'll just give this a go. There is something, I have to say, quite nice in like reading about a scenario that's much worse than ours. But the way that I've been reading also is I have stopped buying books, and I read entirely from the library. So I put holds on books, and then I don't know when exactly they're coming. So it's a bit like a lottery in a way. Whatever becomes available at the library that I put a hold on, like let's say 6 weeks ago and forgotten about, suddenly I get an email saying, this is ready for you to pick up. And I'm so close to the library branch. It's like a 2 minute walk away from me. So I just constantly, it's also an excuse to get out of the house and pick something up. So I've been reading a lot of fiction, I would say almost exclusively fiction, actually, unless it's for research, and I'm kind of doing research on like my next project as well. But other than that, it's all been fiction. Two books that I've been really like struck by recently have been, one is titled Bina, by a writer named Anna Kena Schofield, and the other one's by Olga Tokarczuk, I think is how you pronounce her last name. And the book is Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead. And I just found them really interesting in terms of the way that the narrative is structured. So for example, in Bina, I've actually never had an experience of reading a novel like this. It's almost as though it's written so that like it's very hazy, but when you finally get to the end of the book, that like those layers of haze are lifted from in front of your eyes, and you finally understand what you've been reading all along. There's this like crescendo at the end of like, oh my goodness, this is what has been happening. So I thought it was really skillfully achieved. So I would recommend that book to everyone.
I'll share the links as well. So am I going to see you in London then? Is there any possibility that this Delfina Foundation residency will happen?
Well, we were already supposed to have seen each other a lot by now. Yeah, so the reason Mina is asking me this is because I was going to be doing a residency at the Delfina Foundation in late 2020. But that got pushed back, obviously, for obvious reasons. And it will likely be in 2022 at this point. So, yeah, I'll be spending 3 months in London in 2022. But who knows when? Who's to say what will happen?
Fingers crossed.
Who's to say if the world will still exist next year?
I mean, after the vaccination, if they said, okay, there's no travel ban, you can travel anywhere, where would you go first?
I think I would probably go see my parents in Ankara. Mm-hmm. Not because I'm dying to go to Ankara specifically, but because like I just, they've had a pretty hard time. Like who hasn't, but you know, I think it's a lot more difficult for older people in Turkey if they're not curfews and things. Oh, funnily enough, they're actually getting vaccinated this week, though. So they're far ahead of us.
News. Wow, that's good news. I hope you can see them.
But other than that, where would I go? Gosh, I don't know. I haven't really anywhere, honestly, at this point.
But I'm so happy that I don't fly. Like, I don't use
anymore. I hate flying.
Thank you so much. And I was just, like, so enjoying the train or, like, I don't know, cycling. I said, like, maybe use the digital opportunities to discover the far lands and then
Can I tell you about a guilty pleasure that I've
do.
I watch quarantine videos in South Korea. I have to self-quarantine for 14 days. There's like a lot of YouTube vloggers self-quarantine. They're incredible. I would highly recommend this.
I will definitely watch them. I'm so interested.
But it also makes you realize, you know, wow, there are people who would like travel despite. No, but don't you ever like think about, wow, like being in a crowded room? Like, what was that like? That's so weird and scary.
I really miss it though. That's the, especially like, especially that being in crowded spaces that none of the people know each other and you don't even have to talk with each other. It's just like such a nice, for example, experience if you go to watch a concert, for example, you know, you're all doing the same thing, but you don't have to talk with each other, but you feel that kind of like a, there's like energy in the room that 300 people next to
now, sharing an experience.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, when you see that image, even through a movie or something, you freak out. Yeah. You're like, don't use the elevator, man. It's like 10 people. You freak out.
But I mean, I am, if there's one thing that I'm very happy about, it's that I'm not flying. I hate flying.
I know, me too. I think we can do without flying. Come on, this is just, no, I have nightmares also. Yeah. No, but it was just such a pleasure to talk with you. And I really missed have this conversation.
Likewise. Yeah. Like, I just feel like we should like maybe like create a series where we do this all the time. It's so enjoyable.
That's
well, except you get to do this all the time with people.
Yeah. Hopefully volume 2 soon.
Anytime. Gladly. London. Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. We can even do it together in person.
Yeah, exactly. I'm walking around like in empty.
Can you imagine?
Thank you so much, Erdem.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.